and gives me an idea. I dig in the bottom of my bag for a scrap of paper and a pen and scrawl out, "Let me explain, please. Midnight at the house, 8:17. Then, after checking to make sure that no one is watching me from the few remaining lit windows that overlook the square, I hop up onto the statue's base and stuff the note into the little cavity in the governor's fist. The chance that Alex will think to check there is 1,000,000 to 1, but still, there's a chance. That night, as I'm slipping out of the bedroom, I hear rustling behind me. When I turn around, Gracie's sitting up in bed again, blinking at me, her eyes as reflective as an animal's. I touch my finger to my lips. She does the same, an unconscious mimic, and I slip out the door. When I'm on the street, I look up once toward the window. For a second, I think I see Gracie looking down at me, her face as pale as a moon. But maybe it's just a trick of the shadows skating silently over the side of the house. When I look again, she's gone. The house at 37 Brooks is all dark when I push my way in through the window, and totally silent. He's not here, I think. He didn't come. But a piece of me refuses to believe it. He must have come. I've brought a flashlight with me, and I begin a sweep of the house. My second of the day, refusing for superstitious reasons to call out for him. Somehow I can't stand it. If he doesn't answer, I'll be forced, finally, to accept that he never received my note, or even worse, did receive it, but has decided not to come. In the living room, I stop short. All our things, the blankets, the games, the books, are gone. The warped wooden floor lies bare and exposed under the beam of my flashlight. The furniture sits cold and silent, stripped of all our personal touches, the discarded sweatshirts and half-used bottles of sunscreen. It has been a long time since I've been afraid of the house or frightened of walking into its rooms at night, but now a sense of the cavernous, empty spaces around me comes back. Room after room of tumbling down things, rotting things, rodents blinking at you from dark spaces, and a deep chill runs through me. Alex must have been here after all, to clean up our stuff. The message is as clear to me as any note. He's done with me. For a moment, I even forget to breathe, and then the coldness comes. A surge of it so strong it hits me in the chest like a physical force, like walking straight into the breakers at the beach. My knees buckle and I go into a crouch, shivering uncontrollably. He's gone. A strangled sound works its way out of my throat and breaks the silence around me all at once. Suddenly I'm sobbing loudly into the dark, letting the flashlight fall to the ground and blink out. I fantasize that I'll cry so much I'll fill the house and drown, or be carried away on a river of tears to some distant place. Then I feel a warm hand on the back of my neck, working through a tangle of my hair. Lena? I turn around and Alex is there, bending over me. I can't really make out his expression, but in the limited light it looks hard to me, hard and immobile, as though it's made out of stone. For a second, I'm worried that I'm only dreaming him, but then he touches me again and his hand is solid and warm and rough. Lena, he says again, but he doesn't seem to know what else to say. I scramble to my feet, wiping my face on my forearm. You got my note? I'm trying to gulp back the tears, but just succeed in hiccuping several times.
Note?
Alex repeats. I wish I was still holding the flashlight so I could see his face more clearly. At the same time, I'm terrified of it, and of the distance I might find there. I left you a note at the governor, I said. I wanted you to meet me here.
I didn't get it,
he says. I think I hear a coldness in his voice.
I just came to...
Stop. I can't let him finish. I can't let him say that he came to pack up, that he doesn't want to see me again. It will kill me. Love, the deadliest of all deadly things. Listen, I say, hiccuping through the words. Listen, about today, it wasn't my idea. Carol said I had to meet him, and I couldn't get a message to you, and then we were standing there, and I was thinking about you, and the wilds, and how everything is so changed, and how there's no time, there's no more time for us, and for a second, a single second, I wished I could go back to how things were before. I'm not really making any sense, and I know it. The explanation I'd reviewed so many times in my head is getting all screwed up. words leapfrogging over one another. The excuses seem irrelevant. As I'm speaking, I realize there's only a single thing that really matters. Alex and I are out of time. But I swear, I didn't really wish it. I would never have. If I'd never met you, I could never have. I didn't know what anything meant before you, not really. Alex pulls me toward him and wraps his arms around me. I bury my face in his chest. I seem to fit so precisely, just exactly as though our bodies had been built for each other.
Shh,
he whispers into my hair. He's squeezing me so tightly it hurts a little, but I don't mind. It feels good, like if I wanted to, I could lift my feet off the ground and stop trying at all, and he'd still be holding me up.
I'm not mad at you, Lena.
I pull back just a fraction. I know that even in the dark, I probably look horrible. My eyes are swelling up and my hair is sticking to my face. Thankfully, he keeps his arms around me. But you... I swallow hard, take deep breaths in and out. You took everything away. All her stuff. He looks away for a second. His whole face is swallowed in shadow. When he speaks, his voice is overloud, as though he can only say the words by forcing them out. We always knew this would happen. We knew that we didn't have much time. But... I don't have to say that we've been pretending. We've been acting as if things would never change. He places a hand on either side of my face, wipes the tears away with his thumbs.
Don't cry, okay? No more crying.
He kisses the tip of my nose lightly, then takes one of my hands.
I want to show you something.
There's a small break in his voice, and I think of things coming unhinged, falling apart. He leads me to the staircase. Far above us, the ceiling is rotted away in patches, so the stairs are outlined in silvery light. The staircase must have been magnificent at some point, sweeping upward majestically before splitting in two, leading to landings on either side. I haven't been upstairs since the first time Alex brought me here with Hannah, when we made it a point to explore every room of the house. I didn't even think to check the second floor earlier this afternoon. Here it's even darker than downstairs, if possible, and hotter, too. A black and drifting mist. Alex starts shuffling down the hall, past a row of identical wooden doors.
This way.
Above us, a frantic sound of fluttering. Bats disturbed by the sound of his voice. I let out a little squeak of fear. Mice? Fine. Flying mice? Not so fine. That's another reason I've been sticking to the ground floor. During our initial exploration, we came into what must have been the master bedroom, an enormous room, with the half-collapsed beams of a four-poster bed still standing in the middle of it, and looked up into the gloom and saw dozens and dozens of dark, silent shapes massed along the wooden beams, like horrible black buds dangling along a flower stem ready to drop. When we moved, several of them opened their eyes and seemed to wink at me. The floor was streaked with bat shit. It smelled sickly sweet.
In here, he says.
And though I can't be positive, I think he stops at the door to the master bedroom. I shiver. I have zero desire to see the inside of the bat room again. But Alex is emphatic, so I let him open the door and I pass inside in front of him. As soon as we walk into the room, I gasp and stop so suddenly he bumps into me. The room is incredible. It's transformed.
Well?
There's a note of anxiety in Alex's voice.
What do you think?
I can't answer him immediately. Alex has shoved the old bed out of the way into one of the corners and swept the floor perfectly clean. The windows, or what windows remain, are flung open so the air smells like gardenias and night-blooming jasmine, their scents drifting in on the wind from outside. He has arranged our blanket and books in the center of the room and unraveled a sleeping bag there too, surrounding the whole area with dozens and dozens of candles stuck in funny makeshift canisters, like old cups and mugs or discarded Coca-Cola cans, just like they were at his house in the wilds. But the best part is the ceiling. Or rather, the lack of ceiling. He must have broken through the rotted wood to the roof, And now an enormous patch of sky is once again stretched above our heads. There are fewer stars visible in Portland than on the other side of the border, but it's still beautiful. Even better, the bats, disturbed from their roost, have gone. Far above us, outside, I see several dark shapes looping back and forth across the moon, but as long as they stay in the open air, they don't bother me. All of a sudden, it hits me. He did this for me. Even after what happened today, he came and did this for me. Gratitude overwhelms me. And another feeling, too, bringing with it a twinge of pain. I don't deserve it. I don't deserve him. I turn back to him and can't even speak. His face is lit up with flame and he seems to be glowing, transforming into fire. He is the most beautiful thing I have ever seen. Alex, I start to say but can't finish. Suddenly, I'm almost frightened of him, terrified of his absolute and utter perfection. He leans forward and kisses me, and when he's pressed so close to me with the softness of his t-shirt brushing my face and the smell of suntan lotion and grass coming off his skin, he feels less frightening. It's too dangerous to go back to the wilds. His voice is hoarse as though he's been yelling for a very long time, and a muscle is working furiously in his jaw. So, I brought the wilds here. I thought you would like it. I do. I love it. I press my hands against my chest, wishing I could somehow be even closer to him. I hate skin, I hate bones and bodies. I want to curl up inside of him and be carried there forever. Lena. Different expressions are passing over his face so quickly I can barely catch them all, and his jaw keeps twitching back and forth. I know we don't have much time. Like you said, we hardly have any time at all. No. I bury my face in his chest, wrap my arms around him, and squeeze. Unimaginable, incomprehensible, a life lived without him. The idea breaks me. The fact that he's almost crying breaks me. The fact that he did this for me, the fact that he believes I'm worth it, kills me. He is my world, and my world is him, and without him, there is no world. I won't do it. I won't go through with it. I can't. I want to be with you. I need to be with you. Alex grasps my face, bends down to look in my eyes. His face is blazing now, full of hope. You don't have to go through with it, he says. His words come tumbling out. He's obviously been thinking about this for a long time and only trying not to say it. Lena, you don't have to do anything. We could run away together. To the wilds, just go and never come back. Only, Lena, we couldn't ever come back. You know that, right? They'd kill us both or lock us up forever. But, Lena, we could do it. Kill us both. Of course he's right. A lifetime of running. That's what I've just said I wanted. I take a quick step backward, feeling suddenly dizzy. Wait, I say, just hold on a second. He releases me. The hope dies in his face all at once, and for a moment we just stand there looking at each other. You weren't serious, he says finally. You didn't mean it. No. I did mean it. It's just that you're scared, he says. He walks to the window and stares out at the night, refusing to look at me. His back is terrifying again, so solid and impenetrable, a wall. I'm not scared. I fight a murky feeling. I don't know what I am. I want Alex, and I want my old life, and I want peace and happiness, and I know that I can't live without him, all at the same time. It's okay. His voice is dull. You don't have to explain. My mother, I burst out. Alex turns then, looking startled. I'm as surprised as he is. I didn't even know I was going to say the words until I said them. I don't want to be like her. Don't you understand? I saw what it did to her. I saw how she was... It killed her, Alex. She left me, left my sister, left it all for this thing... inside of her. I won't be like her.
I've never really spoken about this. And I'm surprised by how difficult it is. Now I have to turn away, feeling sick and ashamed that the tears have started again.
Because she wasn't cured? Alex asked softly.
For a moment I can't speak, and I just let myself cry, silently now, hoping he can't tell. When I have control of my voice, I say, it's not just that. Then all of it comes rushing out, the details, things I've never shared with anyone before. She was so different from everybody else. I knew that she was different, that we were different, but it wasn't scary at first. It just felt like our little delicious secret. Mine and hers and Rachel's too, like we were in a cocoon. It was amazing. We kept all the curtains drawn so no one could see in. We used to play this game where she would hide in the hallway and we would try to run past her and she would leap out and grab us, playing goblin, she called it. It always ended in a tickle war. She was always laughing. We were all always laughing. Then, every so often, when we got too loud, she would clap her hands over our mouths and get all tense for a second, listening. I guess she was listening for the neighbors to make sure none of them were alarmed. But no one ever came. Sometimes she would make us blueberry pancakes for dinner as a treat. She picked the blueberries herself. And she was always singing. She had a beautiful voice, just gorgeous, like, honey. My voice cracks, but I can't stop now. The words are pouring, tumbling out. She used to dance, too. I told you that. When I was little, I would stand with my feet on top of hers. She would wrap her arms around me, and we would move slowly around the room while she counted out the beat, tried to teach me about rhythm. I was terrible at it, clumsy, but she always told me I was beautiful. Tears make the floorboards blur beneath my feet. It wasn't all good. Not all the time. Sometimes I would get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and I'd hear her crying. She always tried to muffle it by turning into her pillow, but I knew. It was terrifying when she cried. I'd never seen a grown-up cry before, you know, and the way she did it, the wailing like some kind of animal. And there were days she didn't get out of bed at all. She called those her black days. Alex moves closer to me. I'm shaking so badly I can hardly stand. My whole body feels like it's trying to expel something, cough something up from deep in my chest. I used to pray that God would cure her of the black days, that he would keep her safe for me. I wanted us to stay together. Sometimes it seemed like the praying worked. It was good. Most of the time it was more than good. I can barely bring myself to say these words. I have to force them out in a low whisper. Don't you get it? She left. All that. She gave it up for that thing. Love, amor, deliria nervosa, whatever you want to call it. She gave me up. I'm sorry, Lena, Alex whispers behind me. This time he does reach out. He starts drawing long, slow circles on my back. I lean into him, but I'm not done yet. I swipe at the tears furiously, take a big breath. Everyone thinks she killed herself because she couldn't stand to have the procedure again. They were still trying to cure her, you know. It would have been her fourth time. After her second procedure, they refused to put her under. They thought the anesthesia was interfering with the way the cure was taking. They cut into her brain, Alex, and she was awake. I feel his hand stiffen temporarily, and I know he's just as angry as I am. Then the circles start up again. But I know that's not really why. I shake my head. My mom was brave. She wasn't afraid of pain. That was the whole problem, really. She wasn't afraid. She didn't want to be cured. She didn't want to stop loving my dad. I remember she told me that once, just before she died. They're trying to take him from me, she said. She was smiling so sadly. They're trying to take him. But they can't. She used to wear one of his pins around her neck on a chain. She kept it hidden most of the time, but that night she had it out and was staring at it. It was this strange, long, silver dagger thing with two bright jewels in the hilt, like eyes. My dad used to wear it on his sleeve. After he died, she wore it every day. Never took it off, even to bathe. I suddenly realize that Alex has removed his hand
and taken two steps away from me. I turn around and he's staring at me, white-faced and shocked, as though he's just seen a ghost. What? I wonder if it's possible I've offended him in some way. Something about the way he's staring makes fear start beating at my chest, a frantic flutter. Did I say something wrong? He shakes his head in almost imperceptible motion. The rest of his body stays as straight and tense as a wire stretched between two posts. How big was it? The pin, I mean. His voice sounds strangely high-pitched. The point isn't the pin, Alex. The point is, how big was it? Louder now and forceful. I don't know, like the size of a thumb, maybe? I'm completely baffled by Alex's behavior. He has the most pained look on his face as though he's trying to swallow a whole porcupine. It was originally my grandfather's, made just for him. A reward for performing a special service for the government. Unique. That's what my dad always said anyway. Alex doesn't say anything for a minute. He turns away, and with the moon shining down on him and his profile so hard and straight, he could be built out of stone. I'm glad he's not staring at me anymore, though. He was starting to freak me out. What are you doing tomorrow? He asks finally, slowly, as though every word is an effort. It seems like a weird thing to ask in the middle of a completely unrelated conversation, and I start to get annoyed. Were you even listening to me? Lena, please. There it is. The strangled, choking note again. Just answer me. Are you working? Not until Saturday. I rub my arms. The wind blowing in has a chilly edge to it. It lifts the hair on my arms, makes goosebumps prick up on my legs. Autumn is coming. Why? You have to meet me. I have something to show you. Alex turns back to me again, and his eyes are so wild and black, his face so unfamiliar looking, I take a step backward. You'll have to do better than that. I try to laugh, but what comes out is a little gurgling sound. I'm scared, I want to say. You're scaring me. Can you at least give me a hint? Alex takes a deep breath, and for a minute, I think he won't answer me. But he does. Lena, he says at last, I think your mother is alive. Chapter 21. Liberty in acceptance, peace in enclosure, happiness in renunciation. Words carved above the gates at the entrance to the crypts. When I was in fourth grade, I went on a field trip to the crypts. It's mandated that every child visit at least once in elementary school as part of the government's anti-crime, anti-resistance education. I don't remember much about my visit except for a feeling of utter terror, a dim impression of coldness, of blackened concrete hallways, slicked with mold and moisture, and heavy electronic doors. To be honest, I think I've successfully blocked out most of the memory. The whole purpose of the trip was to traumatize us into staying on the straight and narrow, and they definitely had the traumatized part right. What I do remember is stepping out afterward into the bright sunshine of a beautiful spring day with a sense of overwhelming, overpowering relief, and also confusion, as I realized that in order to exit the crypts, we actually had to descend several staircases to the ground floor. The whole time we'd been inside, even as we climbed, I had the impression of being buried underground, locked several stories under the surface of the earth. That's how dark it was, how close and bad-smelling, like being encased in a coffin with rotting bodies. I also remember that as soon as we got outside, Liz Billman began to cry. Just sob right there while a butterfly flapped around her shoulder. And we were all in shock because Liz Billman was super tough and kind of a bully and hadn't even cried the time she broke her ankle in gym class. I had sworn that day that I would never, ever return to the crypts for any reason. But the morning after my conversation with Alex, I'm standing outside its gates, pacing, one arm wrapped around my stomach. I wasn't able to force anything down this morning, except the thick, black sludge my uncle calls coffee, a decision I am now regretting. I feel like acid is eating my insides. Alex is late. Overhead, the sky is packed tight with enormous black storm clouds.
It's supposed to thunderstorm later, which seems fitting. Beyond the gate, at the end of a short, paved road, the crypt looms black and imposing. Silhouetted against the dark sky, it looks like something out of a nightmare. A dozen or so tiny windows, like the multiple staring eyes of a spider, are scattered across its stone facade. A short field surrounds the crypts on this side, enclosed within the gates. I remember it from my childhood as a meadow, but it is actually just a lawn, closely tended and bare in patches. Still, the vivid green of the grass, where the grass is actually managing to assert itself through the dirt, seems out of place. This seems like a place where nothing should flourish or grow, where the sun should never shine. A place on the edge, at the limit, a place completely removed from time and happiness and life. I guess technically it is on the edge, since the crypts is sitting right on the eastern border, flanked on its rear by the Presumptscot River, and beyond that the wilds. The electrified, or not-so-electrified, fence runs directly into one side of the crypts and begins again on its other side, the building itself serving as a seamless, connective bridge. Hey. Alex is coming down the sidewalk, his hair whipping up around his head. The wind is definitely chilly today. I should have worn a heavier sweatshirt. Alex looks cold, too. He's keeping his arms folded across his chest. Of course, he's just wearing a thin linen shirt, the official guard uniform he wears at the labs. He has his badge swinging around his neck, too. I haven't seen him with it since the first day we spoke. He's even wearing a pair of nice jeans, crisp, dark ones with cuffs that aren't totally ragged and stepped on. This was all part of the plan. To get us both in, he needs to convince the prison administrators that we're on official business. I take comfort in the fact that he's still wearing his scuffed-up sneakers with the ink-stained laces, though. Somehow that little familiar detail makes it possible to be here, with him, doing this. It gives me something to focus on and hold on to. A tiny flash of normalcy in a world that has suddenly become unrecognizable.
"Sorry I'm late," he says.
He stops several feet away from me. I can see the concern in his eyes, even if he manages to keep the rest of his face composed. There are guards circulating the yard and standing just beyond the gate. This is no place for us to touch or reveal any kind of familiarity with each other.
"That's okay?"
My voice cracks. I feel like I might have a fever. Ever since Alex and I spoke last night, my head has been spinning and my body has been burning one second and icy the next. I can hardly think. It's a miracle I was able to get out of the house today. It's a miracle I'm even wearing pants. A double miracle I remembered to wear shoes. My mother might be alive. My mother might be alive. That is the single idea in my mind. The one that has supplanted the possibility of all other rational thought. "Are you ready to do this?" He keeps his voice low and toneless in case the guards will overhear us, but I can detect the note of worry running underneath it.
"I think so," I say.
I try to manage a smile, but my lips feel cracked and dry as stone.
"It might not even be her, right? You could be wrong."
He nods, but I can tell he's sure he hasn't made a mistake. He's sure that my mom is in here, this place, this above-ground tomb. Has been there all this time. The idea is overwhelming. I can't think too much about the possibility that Alex is right. I need to concentrate, focus all my energy on just staying on my feet.
"Come on," he says.
He walks in front of me like he's leading me on official business. I keep my eyes trained on the ground. I'm almost glad that the presence of the guards requires Alex to ignore me. I'm not sure I could handle a conversation right now. A thousand feelings swirl through me, a thousand questions whip around my mind, a thousand suppressed hopes and desires buried long ago, and yet I can't hold on to anything, not a single theory or explanation that makes any kind of sense. Alex had refused to tell me more after his declaration last night.
"You have to see,"
he kept repeating dumbly as though it was the only thing he knew how to say.
"I don't want to get your hopes up for nothing."
And then he'd told me to meet him at the crypts. I think I must have been in shock. The whole time I kept congratulating myself for not freaking out, for not screaming or crying or demanding an explanation, but When I got home later, I realized I had no memory of the walk at all, and hadn't been keeping an eye out for regulators or patrols. I must have just marched stiffly down the street, blind to everything. But now I get the point of shock, of numbness. Without the numbness, I probably wouldn't have been able to get up and dress this morning. I wouldn't have been able to find my way here, and I wouldn't be taking careful steps forward now, pausing a respectful distance behind him as Alex shows his ID badge to a guard at a gate and begins gesturing to me. Alex launches into an explanation he has obviously rehearsed.
There was an incident at her evaluation, he says, his voice icy.
He and the guard are both staring at me, the guard suspiciously. Alex, with as much detachment as he can muster. His eyes are steel, all the warmth drained out of them, and it makes me nervous to know that he can do that so successfully. Become someone else, someone who doesn't have any attachment to me.
Nothing too severe, but her parents and my superiors thought she might benefit from a little reminder about the dangers of disobedience.
The guard flicks his eyes over me. His face is fat and red, the skin on either side of his eyes protruding and puffy, like he is a mound of dough in the middle of rising. Soon, I fantasize, his eyes will be concealed behind flesh altogether.
What kind of incident? He says, snapping his gum.
He shifts the enormous automatic rifle he is carrying to his other shoulder. Alex leans forward so that he and the guard are separated through the gate by only a few inches. He drops his voice, but I can still hear him.
Her favorite color is the color of sunrise, he says.
The guard stares at me for a split second longer and then waves for us to pass through.
Stand back while I get the gate, he says.
He disappears into a guard hut, similar to the one at the labs where Alex is stationed, and after a few seconds, the electronic gates shutter inward. Alex and I start across the courtyard toward the building entrance. With every step, the hulking silhouette of the crypts looms a little larger. The wind picks up, whirling bits of dust across the bleak yard, sending a lone plastic bag tumbling and skipping across the grass. And the air is filled with the kind of electricity that always comes before a thunderstorm, the kind of crazed, vibrating energy that makes it seem like something huge could happen at any second, like the whole world could just dissolve into chaos. I would give anything to have Alex turn around, smile at me, and offer me his hand. Of course he can't. He strides quickly ahead of me, spine stiff, eyes forward. I'm not sure how many people are confined in the crypts. Alex estimated it to be about 3,000. There's hardly any crime at all in Portland, thanks to the cure, but occasionally people do steal things or vandalize or resist police procedurals. Then there are the resistors and sympathizers. If they aren't executed immediately, some of them are left to rot in the crypts. The crypts also serves as Portland's mental institution, and while there may not be much crime, despite the cure, we have our share of crazies just like anywhere else. Alex would say because of the cure we have our crazies. And it's true that early procedures or procedures gone wrong can lead to mental difficulties or a kind of mental fracture. Plus, some people are just never the same after the procedure. They go catatonic, all staring eyes and drool. And if their families can't afford to keep them, they get shoved into the crypts as well to molder and die. Two enormous double doors lead into the crypts. Tiny panes of glass, probably bulletproof and webbed with dirt and the residue of smeared insect parts, give me a blurred view of the long, dark hallway beyond and several flickering electric lights. A typed sign, warped from rain and wind, is taped to the door. It says, "All visitors proceed directly to check-in and security." Alex pauses for just a fraction of a second. "Ready?" he says to me, without looking back.
"Yes," I choke out.
The smell that hits us as we enter nearly jettisons me backward, out the door, through time, back to fourth grade. It's the smell of thousands of unwashed bodies packed closely together, underneath the stinging, burning scent of industrial-strength bleach and cleanser. Overlaying it all is the smell of wet, corridors that aren't ever truly dry, leaking pipes, mold growing behind walls and in all the little twisty places visitors are never allowed to see. Check-in is to our left, and the woman who is manning the desk behind another panel of bulletproof glass is wearing a medical mask. I don't blame her. Strangely, as we approach her desk, she looks up and addresses Alex by name.
Alex,
she says, nodding curtly. Her eyes flicker to me.
Who's that?
Alex repeats his story about the incident at the evaluations. He's obviously on pretty familiar terms with the guard because he uses her first name a couple of times, and I can't see that she's wearing any kind of name tag. She logs our names into the ancient computer on her desk and waves us through to security. Alex says hello to the security personnel here, too, and I admire him for his coolness. I'm having a pretty hard time just undoing my belt before the metal detector. My hands are shaking so badly. The guards at the crypts seem to be about 50% larger than normal people, with hands like tennis rackets and chests as broad as boats. And they're all carrying guns. Big guns. I'm doing my best not to seem utterly terrified, but it's difficult to stay calm when you have to strip down practically to your underwear in front of giants equipped with automatic assault weapons. Eventually, we make it through security. Alex and I dress again in silence, and I'm surprised and pleased when I actually manage to tie my own shoelaces.
Wards 1 through 5 only,
one of the guards calls out as Alex gestures for me to follow him down the hall. The walls are painted a sickly yellow color. In a home or a brightly lit nursery or office, it might be cheerful. But illuminated only by the patchy fluorescent lights that keep buzzing on and off and stained with years and years of water and handprints and squashed insects and I don't want to know what, it seems incredibly depressing, like getting a big smile from someone with blackened, rotting teeth.
You got it, Alex says.
I'm assuming this means that certain areas are restricted from visitors. I follow Alex down one narrow corridor and then another. The hallways are empty, and so far we haven't passed any cells, although as we continue making twists and turns, the sounds of moaning and shrieking begin to float to us, as well as strange animal sounds, bleating and mooing and cawing, like a bunch of people are imitating a barnyard. We must be near the mental ward. We don't pass any other people, though, no nurses or guards or patients. Everything is so still it's almost frightening. Silent, too, except for those awful sounds which seem to emanate from the walls. It seems safe to talk, so I ask Alex, how does everybody know you here?
I come by a lot, he says, as though this is a satisfactory answer.
People don't come by the crypts. It's not exactly up there with the beach. It's not even up there with a public restroom. I'm thinking he won't elaborate further, and I'm about to press him for a more detailed answer when he blows air out of his cheeks and says,
My father's here. That's why I come.
I really didn't think that anything could further surprise me at this point or penetrate the fog in my brain, but this does.
I thought you said your father was dead.
Alex told me a long time ago that his dad had died, but he'd refused to give any details.
He never knew he had a son.
That's the only thing Alex had said, and I figured it meant that his dad was dead before Alex was born. Ahead of me, Alex's shoulders rise and fall. A small sigh.
He is,
he says, and makes an abrupt right turn down a short hallway that ends at a heavy iron door. This is marked with another printed sign. It says, Lifers. Underneath the words, someone has written in pen,
Ha ha.
What are you...
I'm more confused than ever, but I don't have time to finish formulating my question. Alex pushes his way out the door, and the smell that greets us of wind and grass and fresh things is so unexpected and welcome that I stop speaking, taking long, grateful gulps of air. Without realizing it, I've been breathing through my mouth. We're in a tiny courtyard surrounded on all sides by the stained gray sides of the crypts. The grass here is amazingly lush, reaching practically to my knees. A single tree twists upward to our left, and a bird is twittering in its branches. It's surprisingly nice out here, peaceful and pretty, strange to be standing in the middle of a little garden while enclosed by the massive stone walls of the prison, like being at the exact center of a hurricane and finding peace and silence in the middle of so much shrieking damage. Alex has moved several paces away. He is standing, head bowed, with his eyes on the ground. He must have a sense, too, of the peacefulness here, the stillness that seems to hang in the air like a veil, covering everything in softness and rest. The sky above us is darker than it was when we first entered the crypts. Against all the grayness and shadow, the grass stands vivid and electric, as though it is lit up from inside. It will rain at any second. It has to. I have the sensation of the world holding its breath before a giant exhale, balancing, teetering, about to let go.
Here.
Alex's voice rings out, surprisingly loud, and it startles me.
Right here.
He points to a shard of rock sticking up crookedly from the ground.
That's where my father is.
The grass is broken up by dozens of these rocks, which at first glance appeared to be naturally, haphazardly arranged. Then I realize that they've been deliberately tamped down into the earth. Some of them are covered in fading, black markings, mostly illegible. Although on one stone I recognize the word Richard, and on another, died. Tombstones, I realize, as the purpose of the courtyard dawns on me. We're standing in the middle of a graveyard. Alex is staring down at a large chunk of concrete, as flat as a tablet, pressed down into the earth in front of his feet. All the writing is visible here, the words neatly printed in what looks like black marker, their edges slightly blurred as though someone has been continuously retracing them over a long period of time. It says, Warren Sheaths, R.I.P. Warren Sheaths, I say. I want to reach out and slip my hand into Alex's, but I don't think we're safe. There are a few windows surrounding the courtyard on the ground floor, and even though they are thickly coated in grime, someone could walk by at any moment, look out, and see us. Your father? Alex nods, then shakes his shoulders, a sudden movement as though trying to jerk himself away from sleep.
Yeah.
He was here? One side of Alex's mouth quirks up into a smile, but the rest of his face remains stony.
For 14 years.
He draws a slow circle in the dirt with his toe, the first physical sign of discomfort or distraction he's given since we arrived. In that moment, I am in awe of him. Since I've known him, he has done nothing but support me and give me comfort and listen to me, and all this time, he has been carrying the weight of his own secrets, too. What happened? I ask quietly. I mean, what did he... I trail off. I don't want to push the issue. Alex glances at me quickly and looks away.
What did he do?
He says. The hardness has returned to his voice.
I don't know what all the people who end up in Ward 6 do. He thought for himself, stood up for what he believed in, refused to give in.
Ward 6? Alex avoids my eyes carefully.
The dead ward.
He says quietly.
For political prisoners, mostly. They're kept in solitary confinement, and no one ever gets released.
He gestures around him to the other shards of stone poking up through the grass, dozens of makeshift graves.
Ever,
he repeats, and I think of the sign on the door. Lifers, ha ha.
I'm so sorry, Alex.
I would give anything to touch him, but the best I can do is inch closer to him so that our skin is separated by only a few inches. He looks at me then, shooting me a sad smile.
He and my mom were only 16 when they met. Can you believe that?
She was only 18 when she had me. He drops into a squat and traces his father's name with his thumb. I suddenly understand that the reason he comes here so often is to continue darkening the letters as they fade, to keep some record of his father.
They wanted to run away together,
but he was caught before they could finalize a plan. I never knew he'd been taken into custody. I just thought he was dead. My mom thought it would be better for me, and nobody in the wilds knew enough to correct her. I think for my mom, it was easier to believe he had really died. She didn't want to think of him rotting in this place. He continues looping a finger over the letters back and forth. My aunt and uncle told me the truth when I turned 15. They wanted me to know. I came here to meet him, but... I think I see Alex shudder, a sudden stiffening movement of his shoulders and back. Anyway, it was too late. He was dead. Had been dead for a few months and buried here where his remains wouldn't contaminate anything. I feel sick. The walls appear to be pressing closer around us, growing taller and narrower too, so the sky feels more and more remote, an ever-diminishing point. We'll never get out, I think, and then take a deep breath, trying to stay calm. Alex straightens up. Ready? He asks me for the second time this morning. I nod, even though I'm not sure that I am. He allows himself the brief flicker of a smile, and I see for a second a bit of warmth spark up in his eyes. Then he's all business again. I take one last look at the tombstone before we go in. I try to think of a prayer or something appropriate to say, but nothing comes to me. The lessons of the scientists aren't really clear about what happens when you die. Supposedly, you dissipate into the heavenly matter that is God and get absorbed by him, although they also tell us that the cured go to heaven and live forever in perfect harmony and order. Your name. I spin around to face Alex. He has already moved past me, headed back for the door. Alex Warren. He gives an almost imperceptible shake of his head.
Assigned to me, he says.
Your real name is Alex Sheaths, I say, and he nods. He has a secret name, just like me. We stand there for one more moment looking at each other, and in that instant, I feel our connection so strongly, it's as though it achieves physical existence, becomes a hand all around us, cupping us together, protecting us. This is what people are always talking about when they talk about God. This feeling of being held and understood and protected. Feeling this way seems about as close to saying a prayer as you could get, so I follow Alex back inside, holding my breath as we again encounter that awful stink. I follow Alex down a series of serpentine hallways. The sensation of stillness and peace I had in the courtyard is replaced almost immediately by fear so sharp it is like a blade going straight into the core of me, driving down and deep until I can hardly breathe or keep going. At points, the wailing grows louder, almost to a fever pitch, and I have to cover my ears. Then it ebbs away again. Once, we pass a man wearing a long white lab coat, stained with what looks like blood. He is leading a patient on a leash. Neither one looks at us as we pass. We make so many twists and turns, I'm beginning to wonder if Alex is lost, especially as the hallways grow dirtier and the lights above us become fewer in number, so that eventually we are walking through murk and obscurity with a single functioning bulb to light up 20 feet of blackened stone corridor. At intervals, various glowing neon signs appear in the darkness as though they are rising out of the air itself. Ward 1, Ward 2, Ward 3, Ward 4. Alex keeps going, though, and when we pass the hallway that leads to Ward 5, I call out to him, convinced he has gotten confused or lost his way. Alex, I say, but even as I say the word, it strangles me, because just then we come up to a heavy set of double doors marked with a small sign, barely illuminated, so faint I can hardly read it. And yet, it seems to burn as brightly as a thousand suns. Alex turns around, and to my surprise, his face isn't composed at all. His jaw is working, and his eyes are full of pain, and I can tell he hates himself for being there, for being the one to say it, for being the one to show me.
I'm sorry, Lena,
he says. Above him, the sign smolders in the darkness. Ward 6. Chapter 22. Humans, unregulated, are cruel and capricious, violent and selfish, miserable and quarrelsome, It is only after their instincts and basic emotions have been controlled that they can be happy, generous, and good. The Book of Shh. I have a sudden dread of going any farther. That thing in the pit of my stomach squeezes up like a fist, making it hard to breathe. I can't go on. I don't want to know. Maybe we shouldn't, I say. He said we weren't allowed. Alex reaches out for me like he's thinking of touching me, then remembers where we are and forces his arms to his sides.
Don't worry, he says. I have friends here.
It's probably not even her. My voice is rising a little, and I'm worried I might have a meltdown. I lick my lips, trying to keep it together. It was probably just a big mistake. We shouldn't have come in the first place. I want to go home. I know I must sound like a toddler throwing a tantrum, but I can't help it. Walking through those double doors seems absolutely impossible.
Lena, come on. You have to trust me.
Then he does reach out, for just a second, skating one finger across my forearm.
Okay? Trust me.
I do trust you. It's just the air, the stench, the darkness, and the sensation of rot all around me. It makes me want to run. If she isn't here, well, that's bad, but if she is, I think it might be even worse. Alex watches me closely for a second.
You have to know, Lena,
he says finally, firmly, and he's right. I nod. He gives me the barest flicker of a smile, then reaches forward and heaves open the doors to Ward 6. We step into a vestibule that looks exactly like what I imagine a cell in the crypts might be like. The walls and floor are concrete, and whatever color they might once have been painted has now faded to a dingy, mossy gray. A single bulb is set high in the ceiling and barely delivers enough light to illuminate the tiny space. There is a stool in the corner occupied by a guard. This guard is actually normal-sized, skinny even, with acne pockmarks and hair that reminds me of overcooked spaghetti. As soon as Alex and I step through the door, the guard makes a small, reflexive adjustment to his gun, drawing it closer toward his body and swiveling the barrel ever so slightly in our direction. Alex stiffens beside me. All of a sudden, I feel very alert.
Can't be in here, the guard says. Restricted area.
For the first time since entering the crypts, Alex appears uncomfortable. He fiddles nervously with his badge.
I thought Thomas would be here.
The guard gets to his feet. Amazingly, he's not much taller than I am. He's certainly shorter than Alex, but of all the guards I've seen today, he frightens me the most. There's something strange about his eyes, a flatness and hardness that reminds me of a snake. I've never had a gun pointed at me before, and staring into the long black tunnel of its barrel makes me feel like I'm going to faint.
Oh, he's here all right. He's always here, nowadays.
The guard smiles humorlessly, and his fingers dance against the trigger. When he speaks, his lips curl upward, revealing a mouth full of crooked yellow teeth.
What do you know about Thomas?
The room takes on the stillness and charge of the air outside, and reminds me of waiting for thunder to crack. Alex allows himself one small indication of nervousness. He curls and flexes his fingers against his thighs. I can almost see him thinking, trying to figure out what to say next. He must know that mentioning Thomas was a bad decision. Even I heard the contempt and suspicion in the guard's voice as he pronounced the name. After what seems like a terribly long time, but is probably only a few seconds, the blank, official look sweeps down over his face again.
We heard there was some kind of problem, that's all.
The statement is sufficiently vague and a decent assumption. Alex twirls his security badge idly between two fingers. The guard flicks his eyes to it, and I can tell he relaxes. Fortunately, he doesn't try to look at it more closely. Alex has only level 1 security clearance in the labs, which means he barely has the right to visit the janitor's closet, much less parade around restricted areas, there or anywhere else in Portland, as though he owns them. Took you long enough, the guard says flatly. Thomas has been out for months. All the better for CID, I guess. It's not the kind of thing we wanted to publicize.
The CID is the Controlled Information Department. Or, if you're cynical like Hannah, the Corrupt Idiots Department, or the Censorship Implementation Department.
And goosebumps prick up on my arms. Something went very wrong in Ward 6 if the CID got involved.
You know how it is, Alex says.
He has recovered from his temporary slip-up. The confidence and ease returned to his voice.
Impossible to get a straight answer from anyone over there.
Another vague statement, but the guard just nods.
You're telling me.
Then he jerks his head in my direction.
Who's she?
I can feel him staring at the unmarred skin on my neck, noticing that I have no procedural mark. Like many people, he unconsciously recoils, just a few inches, but enough so that the old feeling of humiliation, the feeling of being somehow wrong, creeps over me. I turn my eyes to the ground.
She's nobody,
Alex says, and even though I know he has to say it, it makes my chest ache dully.
I'm supposed to be showing her the crypts, that's all. A re-educational process, if you know what I mean.
I hold my breath, certain that at any second he'll boot us out, almost wishing he would. And yet, just beyond the guard's stool is a single door made out of a heavy, thick metal and protected by an electronic keypad. It reminds me of the bank vault at Central Savings downtown. Through it, I can just make out distant sounds. Human sounds, I think, though it's hard to tell. My mother could be beyond that door. She could be in there. Alex was right. I do have to know. For the first time, I begin to understand fully what Alex told me last night. All this time, my mother might have been alive. While I was breathing, she was breathing too. While I was sleeping, she was sleeping elsewhere. When I was awake thinking of her, she might have been thinking of me too. It's overwhelming, both miraculous and fiercely painful. Alex and the guard eye each other for a minute. Alex continues spinning his badge around one finger, winding and unwinding the chain. It seems to put the guard at ease.
I can't let you back there, he says.
But this time he sounds apologetic. He lowers his gun and sits down on the stool again. I exhale quickly. I've been holding my breath without meaning to.
You're just doing your job, Alex says, keeping his voice neutral. So, you're Thomas's replacement?
That's right. The guard flicks his eyes to me, and again I can feel his gaze lingering on my unmarked neck. I have to stop myself from covering my skin with a hand. But he must decide that we aren't going to be trouble because he looks back to Alex and says,
Frank Dorset got reassigned from 3 in February, after the incident.
Something about the way he says incident sends chills up my spine.
Tough breaks, huh?
Alex leans up against a wall, the picture of casualness. Only I can detect the edge in his voice. He's stalling. He doesn't know what to do from here or how to get us inside. Frank shrugs.
Quieter up here, that's for sure. Nobody in or out.
At least,
almost nobody.
He smiles again, showing off those awful teeth, but his eyes maintain their strange flatness, as though there's a curtain drawn over them. I wonder if this, for him, was a side effect of the cure, or whether he was always like that. He tilts his head back, peering at Alex through narrowed eyes, and his resemblance to a snake grows even stronger.
So, how do you hear about Thomas?
Alex keeps up the unconcerned act, smiling, twirling the badge.
Rumors floating here and there, he says, shrugging. You know how it is.
I know how it is, Frank says. But the CID wasn't too happy about it. Had us on lock for a few months. What exactly did you hear, anyway?
I can tell the question is an important one. Some kind of test. Be careful. I think in Alex's direction as though he might somehow hear me. Alex hesitates for only a second before saying,
Heard he might have sympathies on the other side?
Suddenly it all makes sense. The fact that Alex said,
I have friends here.
The fact that he has seemingly had access to Ward 6 in the past. One of the guards must have been a sympathizer, maybe an active part of the resistance. Alex's constant refrain plays in my head.
There are more of us than you think.
Frank relaxes visibly. Apparently that was the right answer. He seems to decide that Alex is, after all, trustworthy. He strokes the barrel of his gun, which has been resting casually between his knees, as though it is a pet.
That's right. Came as a total shock to me. Of course, I hardly knew him. Saw him sometimes in the break room, once or twice in his shitter, that's about it. Kept to himself, mostly. I guess it makes sense. Must have been getting chatty with the invalids.
This is the first time I've heard anyone in an official capacity acknowledge the existence of the people in the wilds, and I suck in a sharp breath. I know it must be painful for Alex to stand there, talking dismissively about a friend who has been caught for being a sympathizer. The punishment must have been swift and severe, especially since he was on the government payroll. Most likely he was hanged or shot or electrocuted, or thrown into one of the cells to rot, if the courts were merciful and decided against a verdict of death by torture, if he even had a trial. Amazingly, Alex's voice doesn't falter.
What was the tip-off?
Frank keeps massaging his gun, and something about the motion, gentle almost, like he's willing it to life, makes me feel sick.
No tip-off, exactly.
He sweeps his hair off his face, revealing a splotchy red forehead, shiny with sweat. It's much hotter here than it was in the other wards. The air must get trapped in these walls, rotting and festering like everything else in this place.
It figures he must have known something about the escape. He was in charge of cell inspections, and the tunnel didn't just sprout up overnight.
The escape? The words fly out of my mouth before I can help it. My heart starts jolting painfully in my chest. Nobody has ever escaped the crypts. Not ever. For a moment, Frank's hand pauses on the gun, his fingers once again performing a dance on the trigger.
Sure,
he says, keeping his eyes on Alex as though I'm not even there.
You must have heard about it.
Alex shrugs.
A little of this, a little of that. Nothing confirmed.
Frank laughs. It's a terrible sound. It reminds me of the time I saw two seagulls fighting in midair over a scrap of food, screeching as they tumbled toward the ocean.
Oh, it's confirmed, he says. Happened back in February. We got the alarm from Thomas, as a matter of fact. Course, if he was in on it, she might have had a lead time of 6-7 hours.
When he says the word she, the walls seem to collapse around me. I take a quick step backward, bumping up against a wall. It could be her, I think, and for one horrible, guilty second, I'm disappointed. Then I remind myself that she might not be here at all. And in any case, it could have been anyone who escaped,